The Israel-Hamas truce is extended one more day.
Israel's military said it would continue the ceasefire as mediators seek the release of more hostages held in Gaza in exchange for Palestinian prisoners. Hamas said in a statement, the truce would continue for a seventh day.
Plus, Prime Minister Netanyahu is facing pressure inside Israel to stop the ceasefire and to escalate the war.
The right wing want Israel to hit Hamas really hard. They say they don't care about the civilian deaths in Gaza.
And later, Jewish customers flock to a Palestinian restaurant in New York. COP28 is underway in Dubai, and our daily update from Kyiv. Today is Thursday, November 30th, and this is VOA's Flashpoint, Global Crises. Good evening, I'm Steve Karish in Washington. At least three people were killed and eight wounded in a shooting attack in Jerusalem on Thursday at a bus stop near the entrance to the city. The police said the two attackers carried an M16 and a handgun and started shooting at people before being killed at the scene by soldiers and a civilian. Two of the wounded remain in critical condition. Hamas has claimed responsibility for the shooting. Israel's hard-right National Security Minister Itamar Ben-Gvir said the attack proves the need for Israel's war on Hamas. Ben-Gvir added that Israel would continue its policy of easing regulations for issuing gun licenses to private citizens.
This event proves again how we must not show weakness, that we must speak to Hamas only through the rifle scopes, through the war. Against Hamas, we must fight. This event proves another thing. How important the policy of distributing weapons is, despite the criticism. I will continue with this policy of distributing weapons everywhere.
All this as diplomatic efforts are moving forward. The fragile truce between Israel and Hamas has been extended for another day to allow for the release of more hostages and Palestinian prisoners. Reuters' Ryan Chang has that part of the story.
Israel and Hamas have agreed to stop fighting for at least one more day. That decision came Thursday morning, just minutes before the end of a six-day truce. In a statement, Israel's military said it would continue the ceasefire as mediators seek the release of more hostages held in Gaza in exchange for Palestinian prisoners. Hamas said in a statement, the truce would continue for a seventh day. Hours before the announcement, Palestinians in Ramallah celebrated as Israel released 30 Palestinian prisoners from jails in exchange for Hamas releasing 16 Israeli hostages. Among the Palestinians who were released Wednesday was activist Ahed Tamimi, who gained fame for slapping an Israeli soldier when she was a teenager. She was arrested earlier this month on suspicion of inciting violence. Similar scenes of jubilation were seen in southern Israel as some of the Israeli hostages who were captured by Hamas militants on October 7th returned home. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken arrived in Israel on Thursday morning to discuss extending the pause in fighting. In a statement, the White House said U.S. President Joe Biden was determined to secure the release of all hostages held by Hamas after American Liat Beinon was released Wednesday. U.S. officials also want Israel to narrow its zone of combat in the event of an operation in southern Gaza to avoid the repeat of massive Palestinian civilian deaths from Israel's northern Gaza attacks.
That's Ryan Chang of Reuters reporting for us today. Now, we heard a moment ago from Israel's National Security Minister, Itamar Ben-Gvir. He's one of the more right-wing members of Netanyahu's governing coalition. He's of the opinion that the recent pause in the fighting to allow for the return of some of Hamas's hostages in exchange for Palestinians held in Israeli jails is a bad idea. The international pressure on Netanyahu to ease up, to allow for more humanitarian aid, and to limit civilian deaths is well known. What's less out in the open is the pressure from inside Israel to not do any of that, but instead to continue or even increase Israel's military actions in Gaza. And to stay in power, Netanyahu may have to do what they say. For more, I'm joined by Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
Well, Itamar Ben-Gvir said that if Israel goes for a long-term ceasefire, in other words, beyond the current pause that they're talking about, he will pull out of the government, taking his faction with him. Now, even without him, Netanyahu just barely has a majority. But Netanyahu's under a lot of pressure on so many different levels. So Ben-Gvir and the right wing want Israel to hit Hamas really hard. They say they don't care about the civilian deaths in Gaza, that the people in Gaza are the ones who elected Hamas, and that if people have complaints, they should go to Hamas. At the same time, you have, you know, Antony Blinken here saying to Netanyahu, please be very careful about civilian deaths. And so Israel's kind of in this quandary because it's finished the fighting in northern Gaza, more or less. But almost everybody from northern Gaza, both the civilians and Hamas, have now fled to southern Gaza. And so southern Gaza, the lower part of the Gaza Strip, is very crowded. And if Israel starts fighting there, both Hamas gunmen will present a challenge, and it will be extremely difficult to avoid civilian deaths.
Why do they not want a ceasefire?
Israel set two goals at the beginning of this war. One was to get the hostages released, and that's happening, although there are still, as of right now, 145 hostages still being held in Hamas captivity. And the other is to make sure that Hamas can never present a military threat to Israel again. Israel has had several kind of mini wars with Hamas, nothing like the current one, but has had confrontations and fighting and rockets. And I think there's a sense among Ben-Gvir, but not only. The truth is, it's pretty widely adopted in the Israeli public that this is Israel's opportunity to get rid of Hamas, and that if Israel stops the war now, you're basically leaving a situation where Hamas is still in control of Gaza, where Hamas is still ruling Gaza. And Israel says it won't allow that to happen.
Now, Netanyahu was in a pretty perilous position politically before October 7th. His attempts to reform the judiciary were famously unpopular. His coalition is barely hanging on. How important is the support of Ben-Gvir and the right wing to him personally?
Well, I think it is important because that gives him sort of the margin of error. You know, the Israeli political system, you don't vote for the person, you vote for the party. And then the party with the largest number of votes, in this case, Netanyahu's Likud, has to form a coalition to get to the magic number of 61 seats. Now, this coalition has more than that. However, and Netanyahu would still have a razor-thin majority. But that, together with his unpopularity, a poll showed that only 4% of the public trusts him now, that if the election were held tomorrow, Benny Gantz, who is a former chief of staff who's joined his party, has now joined the government, at least for the time of the war, would get twice as many votes as Netanyahu would get. So he does not want to go to elections. The other possibility is that the Likud, his own party, could replace him as party leader, and that's another possibility. So he's very unpopular. He's also on trial in three different corruption investigations. It's the first time that a sitting prime minister is on trial at the same time. And I just saw, by the way, that his corruption trial is set to resume next week. So he's got to fight a war and go to court at the same time. As unpopular as Netanyahu is, there are quite a few people in Israel who are saying this is not the time to try to replace the prime minister. That in the middle of a war that Israel is fighting, and that if Israel does continue the fighting into southern Gaza, then they're expecting a war that's going to continue for weeks, if not months. And there are a lot of people who say that only once the fighting ends will it be time to really look at Netanyahu and consider whether or not he should remain as prime minister.
VOA's Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem. Linda, thanks for your time. Thanks for your reporting on the subject.
Thanks very much.
And now to New York City. Following the October 7th attacks in Israel, both Palestinians and Israelis are sometimes ill at ease. In Manhattan, one restaurant is uniting the two groups despite their differences. Johnny Fernandez has the story.
A yacht restaurant in the East Village is Manhattan's latest hotspot. Owner Abdul Ulanani says his restaurant has several locations in the suburbs of the Big Apple, but he always wanted to bring Palestinian cuisine to the heart of New York City.
I felt like there was a need for that because there wasn't many. I haven't seen any restaurant that's labeled Palestinian. You'll see Iranian, Persian, Pakistani, Desi, Indian, but never actually Palestinian.
But his timing was off. He opened the new location just days after the Hamas attacks of October 7th in Israel. His business experienced a serious backlash online, coming primarily from Israel.
The beginning, it was bad. We were getting a lot of hate messages, one-star reviews.
Ulanani believes the negative reactions were provoked by an online post he wrote about the situation in Gaza.
I just posted about how, like, all these mothers are losing their children. I'm a brand new father. We just had a baby October 20. And I just can't imagine for a single second losing my baby now.
Help came from where Ulanani least expected it. Some members of the Jewish community stepped up to support the restaurant. New York City pediatrician Michael Harris is a frequent customer. He says he loves the restaurant, although he disagrees with political messages some of its decor might carry.
It was a little upsetting, some of the things on the menu. I don't know if you've seen the menu. It says from the river to the sea, which does call for a Palestinian state, from the Jordan River to the Mediterranean Sea, which essentially would dismantle Israel and the Jewish state. So that I didn't love.
Despite that, he says he wants to live in harmony with his neighbors.
I think coexistence, I think dialogue, I think accepting the other, and I think just recognizing the legitimate rights of both sides to their own country and state.
Ulanani says the decor and many words are left for interpretation.
Some people interpret it as a way where it's like kick out all the Jews and just keep it as a full Palestinian state. That was not my interpretation. When I looked it up, it literally meant freedom for Palestinians.
Lindsay Weiss is another Jewish New Yorker who says her curiosity to learn more about the Palestinian culture keeps her coming back.
Coming into a Palestinian restaurant, a Palestinian space, and enjoying Palestinian food and culture gets us closer to imagining what that multicultural, peaceful place might look like.
She believes Jewish and Palestinian groups have more similarities than differences, and food is the one element bringing both groups together.
Food is really important, so I think coming from that place of common ground and exchanging our cultures and putting them in conversation with each other and realizing that, again, we have so much more in common than we have different. And our goals are actually much more in common than they are different.
In a time when peaceful relations seem hard to imagine, this restaurant is showing how two communities can coexist and work together. Johnny Fernandez, VOA News, New York.
The World Health Organization is sounding the alarm about the spread of infectious disease in Gaza. WHO Director General Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus called for Gaza's vulnerable health infrastructure to be safeguarded as the war-torn enclave faces an increased risk of epidemics and challenges in detecting infectious diseases. My colleague Lori London spoke with Doctors Without Borders, pediatric and intensive care physician Dr. Tanya Hajj Hassan, about how colleagues on the ground in Gaza are describing a catastrophic medical and humanitarian situation that is getting worse by the day.
We're hearing nothing from clinicians that are currently in the north of Gaza. The communication has been completely cut off between the north and the south of Gaza. We hear from clinicians in the south of Gaza, where 1.7 million people have been displaced, so the majority of Gaza's population. So in terms of how they're doing themselves, they're displaced. Most of them left the north with just the clothes on their back. So they describe being very cold and trying to find warmer pajamas, jackets for them and their family members as winter approaches. They have very little, if any, access to water, both for drinking and hygiene purposes. And they describe having very difficult access to food. And one of the doctors mentioned not knowing if her home still existed or not in the north and not being able to go back, because with this humanitarian pause or so-called pause, it's unidirectional on the humanitarian corridor on this road from north to south, meaning people can travel north to south, but not south to north. So for the majority of Gaza's population, which has been displaced south, they're unable to go north to bury their dead, to see whether their houses have been destroyed, and to collect anything from their houses, including warmer clothes. What we've heard also from some of them that are working in hospitals in the south is that they've been receiving a lot of gunshot wounds from civilians who have tried to travel north to bury dead or to search for their loved ones under the rubble, and they get shot on the way during this humanitarian pause.
It sounds like the medical professionals, the doctors, are basically living with the bare minimum. What are they doing for patients that are coming in without electricity and potentially medication and ability to treat these people?
There are, I believe, total of around 36 hospitals in the Gaza Strip and only 7 that are still functioning. Those 7 hospitals are in the south, only one of which has capacity to conduct the kinds of complex surgeries that are needed for many of the trauma patients. So really, they're working at less than half, anywhere between 25 and 50% capacity of the pre-existing healthcare system at a time when the healthcare needs have exponentially increased, not only as a consequence of direct injury from airstrikes, which we know there are at least 20 to 30,000 injured people in Gaza right now, but also as a consequence of destruction of all the other primary healthcare facilities, and as a consequence of people with chronic illnesses not having access to care for over 50 days now. So people with diabetes, people with kidney failure, people who are pregnant with complications of pregnancy or who need to deliver. So all of these people with cancer who would normally have regular medical visits and have regular medical needs have not been able to access those. And so some of our colleagues who are working in hospitals in the south mentioned seeing an influx of people who have chronic illnesses and had been in hiding from the aerial bombardment up until the humanitarian pause and are now flooding the hospitals with complications of their chronic illnesses. There's also been a significant increase in acute diseases as a consequence of the displacement of the population, the poor hygiene standards, and the lack of clean water. So they're seeing a lot of diarrheal disease illness, a lot of children who are severely dehydrated and in need of medical care flooding into these hospitals.
What happens when the ceasefire is lifted?
You know, at this point, the humanitarian situation is so catastrophic that even with a permanent ceasefire, hundreds of thousands of Gazans are going to be at risk of death as a consequence of the spread of disease and the lack of shelter and the lack of warmth, lack of clean water, lack of food. They have literally been stripped, excluding the violence. They have been stripped of all the things that are dispensable to human life: water, food, shelter, medical care. So to say that we've had a few days where they're not actively being killed by aerial bombardment, and what will happen when we go back to aerial bombardment, I mean, we are seeing the systematic massacre of an entire civilian population in 1,001 ways.
That's Dr. Tanya Hajj Hassan of Doctors Without Borders. She was speaking with my colleague, Lori London, host of VOA's Issues in the News. You're listening to Flashpoint Global Crises from the Voice of America. I'm Steve Karish in Washington. A look at COP28 in Dubai in a moment. First, though, is our update from Kyiv. The crisis in Ukraine shows no sign of slowing down. On Thursday, Russian forces attacked Ukraine with drones and missiles. They struck residential and industrial areas in the Donetsk region. Meanwhile, President Zelensky made a surprise visit to the frontline city of Kupiansk in the Kharkiv region. Anna Chernikova in Kyiv has the details.
In the early hours of November 30, Russian forces attacked Ukraine with 20 Shahed drones and 8 S-300 missiles. The General Staff of the Armed Forces of Ukraine and Ukrainian Air Forces confirmed the destruction of 14 of the drones. The Ukrainian Armed Forces reported that Russian forces conducted the attack from two directions, from occupied Crimea and from Primorsko-Khtarsk in Russia. According to the Ukrainian authorities, the cities of Pokrovsk, Mirnograd, and Novogrodivka in the Donetsk region were attacked with S-300 missiles. As a result of the attack, residential buildings and other civilian infrastructure, including police station, vehicles, and garages, were destroyed and damaged in the Donetsk region. At least 10 people were injured, 1 person killed, 4 civilians remain missing. The debris of one of the downed drones fell on the territory of an industrial area in the Khmelnytsky region in the western part of the country. No casualties were reported there. However, in Pokrovsk, victims include a family with 2 children, a 16-year-old boy and a 6-month-old baby. In total, an apartment building, 9 private houses, and a police station were damaged. In Novohrodivka, an apartment building took a direct hit from a missile. 5 residents were injured, including a 13-year-old boy who was taken to the hospital in serious condition. Police officers and the state emergency service continued to work at the site of the rocket attack. One man's body was recovered from under the rubble, and 4 more people, including 1 child, are still missing. The search and rescue operation is ongoing. Meanwhile, on Thursday, President Zelensky made a surprise visit to the frontline city of Kupiansk, which is on the border of Kharkiv and Donetsk regions. The president thanked Ukrainian soldiers for protecting Ukraine and presented awards. The president also listened to a report on the current situation on this part of the front line. Officers told the president the situation is tough and intensive fighting continue. Anna Chernikova, VOA News, Kyiv.
The COP28 climate summit is underway in Dubai on Thursday. As Henry Ridgewell reports, the meeting comes at what scientists say is a crucial moment in the climate crisis and the fight against global warming, with warnings that the world is on the brink of irreversible and catastrophic climate damage.
Scientists expect 2023 to go down as the hottest year on record. Fearsome heat, forest fires, and flash storms have characterized a year of extreme weather around the world. Against that urgent backdrop, 70,000 delegates from 197 nations gather in Dubai for the 2-week COP28 climate summit beginning Thursday. Observers call it a crucial moment. Tom Rivett-Carnac is a former strategist at the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change.
This is the launch of what's called the Global Stocktake. So this is the first time since the Paris Agreement the world has taken stock of how are we doing on the objectives we set ourselves back then. And it's challenging to see what that report says. We should be reducing our emissions by 43% by the end of this decade. The latest trajectory suggests they're actually going to rise by 9%, with catastrophic impacts for people all over the world.
The COP summits involve complex negotiations. Most countries want to reduce global emissions. Less developed nations say richer nations are responsible for most historic greenhouse gas emissions, and therefore they should compensate poorer nations for reducing their use of fossil fuels. Poorer nations also need help to adapt to the changing climate. The Paris Agreement aims to limit global warming to no more than 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels by 2050. Visiting Antarctica this month, where the ice is now melting 3 times faster than in the 1990s, the United Nations Secretary General said the culprit was clear.
It is absolutely crucial to end the addiction to fossil fuels. Fossil fuels are the first source of climate change. And I hope that the next COP will be able to decide the phase out of fossil fuels with a clear time frame that is compatible to guarantee that the temperature will not rise more than 1.5 degrees.
The leaders of the world's 2 biggest economies, US President Joe Biden and his Chinese counterpart Xi Jinping, agreed to deepen cooperation on climate change during talks in November. Former UN strategist Tom Rivett-Carnac.
What you see is that if the US and China are in lockstep and have a clear sense of what they want to achieve together, it's much easier for the world to come together around those commitments.
However, a US official said this week that President Biden would not be attending the COP28 talks. No reason was given. US climate envoy John Kerry will be leading day-to-day negotiations for the United States. Henry Ridgewell, VOA News, London.
And that's going to wrap it up for today. There is more VOA coverage 24 hours a day on our website, voanews.com, and across our social media platforms. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thanks for listening. Until tomorrow, I'm Steve Karish.
Stay up to date with VOA Podcasts. Each weekday, International Edition covers the world's biggest stories, while Flashpoint Iran and Flashpoint Ukraine examine their respective regions in depth every week.